Hello there, and welcome to another edition of Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Can I remind you that Podcasts on the Edge is growing in all sorts of new directions, and while it's delivered first on the Financial Mail digital pages, it's also available as an Apple podcast and on Spotify as well, so we're taking over the world. My guest today is both a very nice man and utterly intimidating. He is Professor Anton Eberhardt. He directs the Management Program in Infrastructure Development, Investment and Reform at the UCT Graduate School of Business. He's advised governments both here and around the world. He's written books on energy, written over 100 peer-reviewed papers. He was on the National Planning Commission. But for me, first and foremost, he's the voice of reason on energy, on social media, where I find him most often. Welcome, Anton. In preparation for this podcast, I've been reading the energy and sustainability chapter of the National Development Plan, the chapter I think that you wrote back in 2012. It's hard to believe it was so long ago, and it's also sad because really that plan is surely now lost to us.
Yes, hello, Peter. Good to chat. It is a long time ago. I wouldn't have thought as many. And it is a pity that many of the things that we laid out there are still not fully implemented, although we are starting to see some changes, and no doubt we'll chat about them.
Yeah. Maybe the way to introduce those changes is to just read a couple of tweets that you put out in the past couple of days. I found two or three. According to a presentation, you say, on February the 2nd, according to a presentation by Eskom's CEO today, South Africans will be paying 50% more for electricity by 2025. That's in 4 years' time. I think it is likely to be more, you say. Time for consumers to invest in their own power generation solutions. Then you also tweet a couple of days later, South Africa needs to build 16,000 megawatts of new power by 2030. Eskom can't do it. It's broke. Two reforms needed. One, insulate the grid from Eskom's financial woes and create an independent transmission system and market operator to contract new power. Two, free up self-generation grid-tied market. What's missing, Anton? Why do we not seem? You say you've made progress since 2012, and yes, there is some renewable energy on the ground, in the ground, but why is everything so painfully slow?
Yeah, it is slow, and it's moving to a crisis because we are now in a position of a power shortage. Eskom estimates we are short of now this year around 4,000 megawatts. The CSIR, when they do their numbers, think it's closer to 8,000 megawatts. And you mentioned that sort of power shortage through to 2030 of about 16,000 megawatts. That's to meet 16,000 megawatts of demand, and we'll have to build even more megawatts of power generation capacity to meet that. So I don't think government has fully internalized just what a massive investment program we have ahead of us. So Eskom's current build program is nearing an end, so it's beginning to complete its mega Medupi and Kusile programs. I'll add a little bit more. But it's going to have to decommission about 11,000 megawatts of old kit before 2030. So these are old power stations that were built in the 60s, some of them in the early 70s. Some are now older than 50 years old. In fact, Eskom's average age of its generation fleet is now nearing 40 years.
Is it impossible for a power station to work any longer than that? Or?
Well, it's not impossible, but it just becomes increasingly expensive to keep them going. I I drive 50-year-old cars, right, and I maintain them every year. And if you haven't maintained them well and you haven't done that preventative maintenance, it becomes even more expensive and you start getting equipment failures. The original equipment manufacturers are not necessarily still all around, and it becomes cheaper to build new capacity.
Right. So, Anton, I pick up Engineering News or saw it in online the other day, and it tells me that the National Energy Regulator, this is NERSA, that its electricity subcommittee has decided on February 5, that's earlier this week, not to approve, this is despite all of Eskom's problems, Eskom's application for the emergency procurement of electricity from 8 private generators under a short-term power purchase plan program. How is that even possible? How can that even happen? We are load shedding at the moment, I think. We're parts of the country were yesterday. Why are we not all working towards the same objective here? Surely it's obvious what needs to be done.
Good question, Peter. I used to be on the board of the regulators from 97 through to 2004. So I have some sense of how it operates. But of course, in that period, we had a surplus capacity, and this wasn't the issue. I don't think the regulator has either fully internalized just what a mountain we need to climb in terms of new investment. I mean, let's just think about how could that be delivered, right? Eskom can't do it. It's broke. It cannot borrow more on its balance sheet. It has debt of around 480 billion rand. It has no possibility of raising new finance to invest in new capacity. Government can't do it. It's fiscally constrained. COVID has just made that even worse. So South Africa is now dependent on the private sector to invest in new power. And this is where we run into this conundrum. It's NERSA, it's the relevant ministers as well. You ask, why aren't we responding with more urgency to this need? And I think it's a kind of ideological fog, you know, which doesn't enable people to see clearly first the problem and then secondly what needs to be done about it. People still hold on to this notion of the developmental state and that Eskom is a key instrument in delivering for the state to power our economy and to improve welfare. Well, frankly, we now know that it's not doing that, right? It's not keeping the lights on. The power cuts are extraordinarily damaging to our economy. I think they are a huge constraint on post-COVID economic recovery. And they're draining the fiscus. I mean, again, I don't think there's a full appreciation just about how big those numbers are. Last year, the fiscus transferred 49 billion rand to Eskom as a bailout. This year, it's 56 billion rand.
What does it spend that money doing?
It's mainly to enable it to make its debt repayments.
So it's not on maintenance. It's not on... No.
And its debt and principal repayments now are huge. I mean, this year, it has a debt obligation, both principal repayments and interest, of 94 billion rand. To put that in perspective, Eskom's total revenues from electricity sales are around 180, 190 billion. You know, then it has to buy coal, it has to pay its staff. It's simply not generating enough cash to service its debt. Its debt service cover ratio is less than 0.5.
So your suggestion in your tweet earlier this week was to separate, and there is a plan to do this anyway, is to the government wants to separate it out into three areas, generation, transmission, I forget the other one, but the
distribution,
distribution, of course, the last few miles, but it wants to control all of them, right? So instead of having a truly independent producer who will buy from anybody who's got electricity to sell, under the government's plan, the network operator will buy from Eskom and other people, but it will always buy something from Eskom, and there's this crazy notion that Eskom will compete within itself as if it were working, you know, like a well-oiled machine. I think the question that I wanted to ask was, I mean, is there any real possibility? We know what the ANC is. We know that it's ideologically stuck and can't move past this developmental state. Is there any real possibility, even though it's obvious to possibly you and other experts, of the private sector genuinely being able to build power stations or to build generating capacity and to sell it back into the grid?
Without question. And they've demonstrated their willingness and ability to do it already, right? So the renewable energy IPP program, the Independent Power Program, which was kicked off in 2011 and ran a series of highly, highly effective reverse auctions, right? Reverse in the sense that it's the lowest bid that gets the contract.
Yes.
Brought in over those four major auctions, more than 2 billion rand in more than 100 projects, totaling around 6,500 megawatts.
Right.
Until that program was stopped by COCO and Molefe when they were there. And we've had this really tragic for the sector and for the economy, a 5-year hiatus of no new procurements. I mean, it's an astonishing fact that our energy minister has had his portfolio now for nearly 2 years. In that period, that we have not seen one new government-backed contract for new power, right? We've been in treading water, effectively, for 5 years. So this increases the urgency. But let me come back to that question of unbundling and try and explain why it's so important and whether it will happen. So I was asked by the president late end of 2018 when load shedding started again to chair the Eskom sustainability task team. And he asked us to do three things. I mean, one was around how do we restore governance and capabilities in Eskom? The second was how do we put Eskom on a more financially sustainable path? But very interestingly, he said, you know, even if we fix Eskom now, how do we prevent them coming back again with the begging bowl in a few years' time? How do we put them on a sustainable path, not just financially, but restructure it possibly so that we have a more sustainable business model? And so we put forward these recommendations. By the way, they're not new. They were in the 1998 energy policy white paper, but never implemented and stopped by Alec Irwin. But to do what the rest of the world is doing, right? 106 countries around the world have embarked on this path of separating out the grid from generation. And the logic is this. You can get competition in the generation side. Anyone can come in and build power stations. In fact, with new technologies, with the growth of private capital markets, it's becoming easier and easier to do that and to get more and more competition. But you need the heart of the system, the transmission grid, to be protected and to be the platform for doing the planning, for doing the procurement and the contracting of least cost power so that you get this competitive environment. Eskom with the grid obviously has a conflict of interest, right? It's has its own generators, and then it's running the grid as well and makes it difficult for other parties to access the grid. So this restructuring is absolutely fundamental to and will be the most profound change in the sector in 100 years. And the president's accepted these proposals. They were in his SONA speeches. They were further developed in the public enterprises Eskom roadmap. And they're now being implemented by Eskom. And this is the most interesting change, because of course one would expect a dominant incumbent utility to resist competition to its monopoly. But the new leadership in Eskom have realized this truth, that they cannot keep the lights on anymore by themselves. That old kit is deteriorating every day. It's more and more expensive. And they, as I said earlier, they don't have the balance sheet to invest in new power. So they understand if we do keep the lights on, and of course they always judged by that, right?
Yeah.
They need to be helped by the private sector, and we need now to make it easier for the private sector to come in and invest. And of course, restructuring is part of doing that, because you create this transparent and independent and fair platform. So they've started that process of ring fencing these businesses. It will result in a separate subsidiary company for the transmission, or what we call the ITSMO, the Independent Transmission and System and Market Operator, by the end of this year. And then once the legislation is passed and once it's the licenses have been transferred, etc., that will go out as a separate state-owned
Anton,
wood company.
Do you believe that will actually happen?
Look, I think it's a fair question to say, are there risks that this could still be held up? And of course, this is a contested space, right? The unions are not very happy. They think of unbundling as a first step to privatization, even though in our engagements, and certainly the president's spent a lot of time, a lot of political capital with organized labor, explaining that that is not the intention, right? The grid will not be privatized. And in fact, I don't think it should. It's a natural monopoly.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
It makes sense for the state to manage the heart of the system. I am very encouraged by the commitment of the current ESCOM leadership. So they have done a lot already to start doing this ring fencing, to get separate accounts, to start allocating staff to the different divisions. And the next step is to separate out the assets and finally the debt, which is the most complicated thing, splitting between the three entities. But he's doing it. I think the president's key ministers, Pravin Gordhan as the shareholder minister in DPE and Gwede Mantashe, the energy minister, it's are less enthusiastic. But even that they have, over the months now, begun to talk about this as being an inevitability. I think some would like to see the process stop with a subsidiary company of ESCOM Holdings. But I think that the momentum will be built to finally take it to that step where it goes out completely.
Back in 2012, you were talking in the NDP about the possibility of everybody being able to sell electricity back onto the grid.
Yeah, so we've got some progress. I do it. I have a home solar PV system with batteries, and I sell a great deal of surplus back into the grid. Problem is that there's absolutely crazy regulation from the city that on an annual basis, they'll cancel any surpluses outright. So they want me still to be a net consumer, although I'm drawing almost nothing from the city, including in winter, by the way. I mean, it's only a couple of days that I might need to recharge my batteries. So that is to change, and I think that will change. There have been other interesting developments recently. There's a company called Solar Group, very smart company that has just had a solar plant in the Northern Cape licensed, and it is wheeling. It will wheel once it's built the system. It will wheel that electricity across the grid.
Yeah.
And it just signed an agreement with Amazon. Right? Amazon has large energy using data centers in Cape Town.
Yeah.
And its international office has said you've got to go 100% renewables by 2025. So this is happening. The big constraint there is the licensing. NERSA, as you indicated earlier, is something of a roadblock at the moment. And hence, again, our recommendations for regulatory reform there. I mean, why do we actually need licenses, right? I mean, what's being protected here? So suggestions are now saying, well, small generators, at least up to 50 megawatts, should not require a license from NERSA. I mean, if the planners want to know what's going on and, you know, who's building what so that we can plan the overall system, we'll require them to register. But again, that should not be a discretionary bureaucratic step. That should be an automated online process.
What strikes me about all of it is how slow it is. You know, I think I'm right in saying, you say Gwede Mantashe has been Minister of Energy now for 2 years. Cyril Ramaphosa has been president for, I think, almost to the day, 3 years now. And I don't think that we've created a single new megawatt of electricity in all that time. I might be wrong.
Yeah, as I said in the beginning, ESCOM is adding a little bit as it completes Medupi and Kusile. But, no new power stations significantly coming online, new private ones.
In Ramaphosa's, the president's recovery plan published last year, he talks about specific interventions in energy. And let me just run through them and ask you what's plausible and what's not. So the first is creating a transmission company from a restructured ESCOM and facilitating electricity trading. So we've spoken about that, and you think that's going to happen. securing additional 550 megawatts procured by ESCOM that will be connected by December 2020. Did that happen?
So I think that refers to when you do that, that holdup at the regulator at the moment. So ESCOM did go out on its own little procurement, you know, co-generators, for example.
So that didn't happen?
Well, I think it still will happen.
Yeah, but it didn't happen by December 2020.
No.
Connection of additional 128 megawatts of IPP capacity. Where is that coming from?
So there was an attempt to talk to the existing renewable energy IPPs that actually generate more power than they contracted for.
Oh, right.
And basically, the contracts don't allow for that extra to be sold.
They cap it.
Yeah. So I think that has started to happen. Certainly, the agreements around it, whether the final contracts are in place, I'm not sure.
Right. Connection of bid window for IPP capacity, 1338 megawatts between January and June 21 and 279 by March 2022. So that's about 1,500, almost 1,600 megawatts between in the next year. I've lost track of the bid windows. What is it? Bid window four opened
in 2014.
Yeah. That's right. That was bid window.
So that's what he's referring to there. So those are the projects that were awarded in 2015 and then were held up by ESCOM not signing. So when soon after Ramaphosa came in, one of the first things that happened was under Jeff Radebe, who was energy minister there, that those contracts were signed. So they're all being built, and quite a few of them already come online.
Okay. Enabling capacity through Section 34 to unlock 2,000 megawatts. What is Section 34?
So this is one of the crazy features of the South African planning and investment environment. I mean, I think we have one of the most dirigist command and control sectors in the world. I mean, certainly more than Russia or China. So the regulator cannot license a new generation plant that is not in the IRP electricity plan unless the energy minister provides a letter of deviation. And then the Act also allows the minister to make these Section 34 determinations, and they're extraordinary. They're based on the electricity plan, but then what he says, okay, we are going to procure so many megawatts from this source and that source by a certain date from certain people, and ESCOM or some other body would purchase it. So these determinations then provide the regulatory framework for the IPP office to then launch these procurements.
Right.
So the only one that has been launched so far is the so-called risk mitigation IPP program. So it was part of those determinations that the minister made, far too late, by the way, in my view. I mean, he said, you know, we have to procure power within months, and the months have become years. And we still haven't actually signed contracts, but at least that request for proposal is out and closes soon, and that's for 2,000 megawatts. It'll be very interesting to see what comes in there, because it's a very complicated procurement, because they required firm power to be produced between 5 a.m. in the morning and 9 o'clock at night. So that kind of, you know, rules out wind, rules out solar by itself. And by the way, solar and wind are the cheapest sources. But I think we will see solar and batteries coming in, and then it'll be very interesting to see how they compare versus gas, and in particular these big power ships that have been bidding as well. You know, that's one sort of Anchor and Saldana and Richards Bay. And
talking about batteries, I read the other day that, I think it was in Western Australia, the batteries are now going to be installed that will be able to deliver almost 2,000 megawatts.
This is a really rapidly moving field. You know, I mean, just a year ago, the biggest utility battery was 100 megawatt hours. I can't forget which. And that was the famous Tesla battery. You know, sort of Elon Musk said to South Australia, because they were having some power problems, he said, I, I can get to you this battery in 100 days. If I don't get it to you in 100 days, you don't have to pay me.
Yeah.
And since then, we've just seen more and more of these kind of contracts, and each is bigger, huge battery in California now. And this is the technology we need to watch, because like solar, the costs are falling. I mean, solar prices over the last 7-8 years have dropped more than 80%. You know, they have what they call a learning curve, which means every doubling of the volume produced and manufactured, they get a 20% reduction in cost at the moment. And that's just keeps continuing. And battery costs are now falling as well. So we're seeing innovation in technology, but mostly we're seeing huge advances in manufacture. You know, Elon Musk always says the biggest problem is not the fundamental technology. It's how to do manufacturing really well. And he's building these gigafactories now, which are getting scale and bringing costs down significantly.
And a battery that size would make an enormous difference to this country. You wouldn't need Section 34 to unlock 2,000 megawatts. You would just buy a battery big enough to plonk somewhere and attach it to the grid, which would run it down, presumably, during the night when it needed it or poor weather.
Yeah, that's, I mean, what the system needs optimally is we need new power, right? So batteries just help you to shift that power to times when you need it, but we still need more generation capacity, and that's the biggest challenge. And what the plans are telling us, not just in this country, but across the globe, is because of these massive cost reductions in solar and wind, that's what you start with now. You build as much as you can to meet your demand. But of course, these are variable resources, right? They, you know, the critiques of the power always, well, the sun doesn't shine at night and the wind doesn't always blow. It's partly true, of course, with sun, but with wind, it's less so if you have wind all over the country and the wind blows at different times. But you still need to complement these resources with fast reacting, flexible, complementary sources. So that could be pump storage, right? We have some very significant pump storage schemes here at the moment, and Eskom, when it has surplus power, pumps the water up to the top dams, and then when we need it during peak periods in the early evenings, it runs down. I mean, one of the reasons we're actually having load shedding at strange times, like on weekends at the moment, is that Eskom's short of energy, right? So if we just had more solar during the day, we could be using some of that surplus solar to be pumping water up to the dams and then to be running down. Yeah. So pump storage is a technology. Gas turbines are perfect. You know, a gas turbine is like a big Boeing or GE engine, and we know how quickly those get fire from idling to full power. And that's what you need. You need highly responsive technologies that can quickly ramp up to compensate for when the sun goes down, for example, or when the wind is variable.
Do we have the gas, Anton? I presume what we have now, we would have to import, no? I mean,
So, I mean, the only real options for us on gas now are liquefied natural gas.
Yeah. And
that would need to come on ships. There's a huge debate in the sector at the moment whether we should do it at all. So gas is in the IRP electricity plan. But increasingly, you know, it goes back to the earlier discussion on batteries. It looks like there are real possibilities that as costs come down on batteries, they would be competitive with gas. So we don't know that fully yet. I mean, my sense is that we could go for a least regret kind of option.
Yeah.
We could go with these floaters, these floating regas and gasification units where, you know, the LNG gets delivered, the regas ship transfers the liquefied natural gas into gas, and then you build a power station onshore. And the infrastructure is mostly on the ships, right? I mean, so if we don't need it in 10 years' time, those ships go elsewhere.
The last item on this little list is and this is Gwede Mantashe again, typically, prepare for the nuclear program at a pace and rate that is affordable. So what is that again? Is that an idea, just another ideological tick, or is it a reasonable proposition to have a little bit more nuclear power because it's stable and we're not scared of it, and you know, we'll only build it when we can afford it. Is that clear thinking?
It's a very peculiar initiative, and it's very hard to understand from a political economy perspective, because the nuclear constituency is not a very broad one, right? I mean, we certainly have a cadre of highly skilled scientists and engineers that have been trained abroad and are fairly vocal, and they try to always keep the Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa expanding, and they're very closely linked to Nahawu, who's been very effective in lobbying for them. But overall, it's a small constituency. So why has this been done, given that nuclear doesn't feature in our electricity plans, right? It doesn't feature in any of the least cost options, not in the 2010 plan and not in the 2019 plan. It was forced in as a, inverted commas, policy adjustment. So why, again? So of course, the opportunities for rent seeking, right? These very concentrated, big mega projects create lots of opportunities for rent seeking that renewables don't, which renewables by their nature are distributed, the resource is distributed. They're built in small incremental units. There's much more competition. None of that applies in nuclear. And of course, they're mostly now government-to-government deals, and so much, much less transparency. So my concerns with nuclear are primarily economic. There is no way that current technology, so these very large reactor units, larger than 1,000 megawatt each, the largest right up to 1,600 megawatts, using the so-called Generation 3 Plus technology with all the additional safety, passive safety requirements, can compete. The costs are too high. The only country in the world that is building them at a reasonable cost is China, but they have a massive program there, so they're getting sort of economies of scale as and learning there. There's no history of them exporting competitive technology. And the other vendors, you know, Russia and the French and the US, Japan with Westinghouse, their Generation 3 Plus units have been extraordinarily expensive. The one potential hope for the future is small modular reactors. So the logic there is that one would try and standardize the technology at a smaller and incremental scale. So you build as much of the units in factories and then ship to site and connect and assemble. But there's no commercial small modular nuclear reactor currently available that's operating. Russia's got two that are on a barge and on a ship, but there are no land-based ones. So this is technology in development. And it's obviously crazy to be thinking about ordering small modular nuclear reactors when we don't even have prototypes up and running to prove concepts. But it is, I mean, I have to say it's a very fast-moving area, and there's a huge amount of investment going into this in a range of countries, including actually for the first time from the private sector. So it's something we need to watch. But I think Gwede's request for information now from nuclear vendors is just a distraction. It's really not helping us do anything. And in fact, it's delaying him getting the next round, fifth round of the REAP auctions actually off the ground.
Lovely talking to you, Anton. I want to come back. I want to end with just coming back to one of your recent tweets where you say South Africa needs to build 16,000 megawatts of new power by 2030. That assumes that we have some economic growth by 2030 and that we will need that amount of energy, even if we do lose 11,000 megawatts because of redundancy, you know, because of old plant. It's 16,000 watts, perhaps, if you look at the economy now, not a little overambitious.
No, we would need to build more than that, in my view. I mean, just remember there are a couple of trends happening with Eskom. So is this decommissioning of old units? We're already short of power, so we don't have enough reserve margin now to deal with unexpected breakages. And then we have to factor in this long-term decline in the performance of Eskom's plant. And I think this is the biggest shift that's actually happening now in the consciousness of government and ESCOM leadership. You know, in the past, the solution was always, well, ESCOM's just got to fix its power stations, right? I mean, then everything's okay. We used to have 90% availability. The availability now, by the way, I was just looking at the numbers, is 59%. So it is seasonal. It's slightly high in winter, but still 90 down to 59% over 15 years or so. But that trend is inexorable in my view. It's old kit, and it's just really, really difficult to reverse that trend. They could try and stabilize it, but the long-term trend is down. So we're short of power. We have to decommission more power. The long-term trend is down. And even if we model very low electricity growth, and the modelers are doing this, by the way, very conservatively now, there's no question we need masses of amounts of new investment, and that new investment has to be private.
Well, Anton, I hope that you are able to, in a position to prod away at the powers that be, because it's no fun not having electricity, and it's no fun living in a country where the possibility of electricity is not that it's scarce, but I mean, electricity powers people's dreams, you know, and it powers investment, and we need it.
Precisely, and it could really hobble our post-COVID economic recovery. So, I mean, in my view, it's one of the most important issues we need to be dealing with.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Look after yourself and stay safe. And thank you so much for joining me on Podcast from the Edge today.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for joining me, and thank you for joining Anton Eberhardt. He's a wonderful guy, full of patience and wisdom and thoughtfulness. The sort of person you want in your trench when you're in an energy hole. And the government is lucky to have people like him they can turn to when they need them. The question is whether they listen to them as well when they need them. Anyway, I'll be back next week with another guest, hopefully as interesting as Anton, to talk about the issues that matter in our lives in South Africa as we plow into 2021, as the news about the vaccines and the virus becomes more and more grim. We'll need to find a way through it, and we can do it together. Please join me again next week.